Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is appeal numbers 112267 and others. And we will start, I suppose, with Ms. Rosulskis. I hope I pronounced that more or less.
I may be one of the few people in the room who knows how to pronounce that. Ms. Rosulskis, nice to see you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Victoria Rosulskis, and I represent Kenneth Jones in this matter. This is a case that has arrived to this Court from a jury trial that related to a drug investigation that included a wiretap and a search warrant as part of the overall development of evidence in the case. The issues that are arising in this case for Mr. Jones, in my opinion, are neither unique nor legally unexplored in the world of Fourth Amendment constitutional law. However, we are asking the Court then to apply that law as it currently exists and to reverse, consequently, the possession charge relating to the controlled substance and the possession and possession with intent to distribute components of it and the possession of a firearm by a felon. As to the last issue that was raised by Mr. Jones, I'd like to take that up first and just briefly state that we do agree with the United States of America regarding their position on the Fair Sentencing Act. It matches ours, and we do urge this Court to accept that and to rule accordingly and then return this case back for resentencing under the Fair Sentencing Act.
So I'm interested. I mean, I think that's clear. The government has conceded that Dorsey is clear. But you are challenging both the warrant to search the Eagledale residence and then also, as I understand it, the sufficiency of the evidence linking Mr. Jones to the various items that were found there.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So in terms of the warrant, it seems to me they did have evidence that shows that from time to time he spent the night there. So why wouldn't that be enough to support simply the warrant?
Well, I think that's the actual fundamental question, and that's the way I've narrowed it down on that search warrant. Because when you read the entire search warrant, as fat as it is and as thick as it is, when it comes down to Mr. Jones, there are only two things that are said about the location on Eagledale, and that is that we got a warrant once for the cell location, and we drove by on those same dates and saw an automobile registered to him.
But at a very early morning hour, a time one wouldn't just drop over for a visit, or it had some pretty strong indicia that he was an overnight. He was there overnight.
It was, I think it was like 5:38 in the morning and like 7:01 in the morning when they drove by. And
so is it enough to show that somebody stays overnight, I guess is the question, because the district court, as Judge Tinder is implying, found that that was at least enough to show that he was an overnight guest, that he hadn't just dropped by. And if he was there on two dates in January, and then, of course, there, again, we're not going to rely on the fact that he was there, but he's there the two dates that the GPS identifies him, and his car's parked there. So how much more would be needed to show that he actually is an occasional resident of that house?
I think, well, that's something that I've given some thought to. I think part of the issue that I would wrap around in answering that question is that warrant that was sought to be able to track his cell phone was actually for up to 45 days. At some point in time, I concede that after X number of days, you would say, you know, I think he has some huge connection with this residence, and in fact, it may be his residence. What I am focusing on, and I think the question is, can it be that on two occasions, and Judge Barker's finding, which I think is the erroneous one, as far as this search warrant goes, is the court concluded that being at a location in the early hours leads to the common sense conclusion that it was defendant's residence. I don't think that is the common sense conclusion. It leads to the common sense conclusion that the defendant may be there, that he's been there twice. But is that enough to say it's his residence? The reason I am selecting so carefully the word residence is that because there's a panoply of law that applies as to what can be done and what conclusions one can draw when you say it's your residence.
Of course,
well, that's
of course,
crucial, yeah.
But in the drug world, residence has kind of a loose meaning. It's where someone's been staying. I'm sure you've heard that expression and so forth. The way we use residence, the magistrate judge has the ability to use his common sense, his experience in drug investigations, to understand that perhaps to mean something maybe a little different than permanent residence.
Could indeed, but is it two times enough to draw the conclusion? Because the other part of that common sense discussion of what goes on in certain people's lives and how they conduct themselves is that someone may visit one person twice a month, another person four times a month. Are we then going to, under the law, come to the conclusion that as long as the government can find you in one location twice, that it's therefore your residence, and therefore we can draw conclusions that you have drugs there, that you have contraband there, that you're conducting illegal activity? That leap is pretty dramatic. If, I believe my time's up.
You should finish your response to Judge Tinder.
If we did that, it really wouldn't make any difference about what the world, the legal world of residence constitutes today, because you can simply say they were there twice, we get a search warrant.
Okay, thank you very much. We will next hear, as I have it, from Mr. Daisy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. Mr. Mockaby is on direct appeal. Mr. Mockaby wisely pled guilty, perhaps unwisely, without a plea agreement prior to the commencement of the trial. We preserved the Demaret ex post facto guideline issue both by objections to the pre-sentence investigation and through a sentencing memorandum and in the sentencing hearing itself. That's a dead issue, of course, unless the Supreme Court rescues it in Pew.
Well, that should be coming out any time now.
I live-blogged it yesterday thinking
perhaps. Didn't happen yesterday.
No, it didn't, but it should be coming out one of these days. So the argument is that was a six-point swing in the offense level calculation for Mr. Mockaby for guidelines that were enacted some 8 or 9 months after he was indicted and on an emergency basis. And so I would argue if Pew comes out Mr. Mockaby's direction, the case should be remanded for resentencing on that issue. The leader-organizer argument seems to me continues to be sort of a thorn in everybody's side, including the courts. I don't suppose I supplemented this Rosales case that the court released last week, but I'm not so sure that it adds a lot to the analysis that the court has traditionally applied toward these questions. The lesson might be...
The role certainly does seem to be much more significant than, say, Jones or Drake or Young or quite a few others. He runs this house at 781 West 25th.
I'm not so sure that that's true, that he runs the house. I mean, that may be a conclusion, but it was, of course, Mr. Small's house for 5 or 6 years before he allowed Mr. Mockaby to use the upstairs to sell drugs. The notion that he allowed one person in at a time to sell drugs to, I'm not so sure it's a fair conclusion that he ran the house for that reason. Most criminals don't operate in daylight and allow lots of other people to observe their crimes. It seems to me that just makes sense for one that's engaged in an illegal activity to confine the witnesses to that illegal activity to the buyer and seller. And it's true, he decided that he wouldn't let the entire neighborhood in at a time, or even those waiting outside at once to observe drug transactions. So the factors that the United States argued and that the district court...
Did he also have more money, too?
He did.
$88,000 instead of about half that?
Yeah. He did.
And didn't he provide Alicia Drake some advice about how she was doing her end of end of the business or where she might be slipping up?
Those two communicated regularly, and that included their ongoing relationship as to drugs, yes. As I recall, Drake sort of implied, we're in this together, or we're, your business is my business, or something to that nature in one of those calls.
And then out of the 10,000 calls, weren't 7,500 through him one way or the other, either made by him or made to him?
Of course, it was his phone, or his phone was one of the primary phones tapped. But yes, it's a fair conclusion. He got up every morning and figured out a way to sell drugs along the way. But the argument that it made him the boss, at least using this Rosales characterization, I think is a stretch. The more money thing, I suppose another teaching of the Rosales is it's a mistake to get terribly hung up on a division of the spoils. But I would argue that a drug case isn't like the James gang just robbed a bank and there's a pool of money that's to be divided among, you know, several participants and according to, with the leader being entitled to a greater share. This is just simply drug proceeds from persons each engaged in buying and selling drugs. And it seems in a way it's sort of a musical chairs. Who had the most money when the police came to kick the doors in is a poor way to assess that a claimed right to a greater percentage of the spoils existed in favor of Mr. Maccabee.
All right. I think that's your time.
It is my time,
okay.
And I appreciate the
very much
attention.
Then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mullins?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Brian Mullins, and I represent Devon Young. We are asking the Court to vacate Devon Young's conviction for Count 1, which is the conviction for conspiracy. We believe that it is undisputed at this point that Mr. Young did not conspire with Ramon Maccabee, who was appears to be the head of this conspiracy. The government does not attempt to support his conviction by citing evidence of his relationship with Mr. Maccabee. So
what the government's arguing, really, as I understand their brief, is they're focusing on Gary Davis, and they're also focusing on Mr. French.
Correct.
So why couldn't a rational jury find that the relationship between Young and Davis, let's say, is one of cooperating in this larger agreement to distribute the cocaine and not just an incidental Davis joyriding along with cocaine tucked in his underwear off to Columbus, Indiana? I'm not saying you had to see it that way, but if a jury could see it that way, that's enough.
Well, we do not believe there was any evidence of an agreement between Mr. Davis and Mr. Young.
Why not an inference from conduct? You know, Young goes, he picks up Davis, gives Davis the cocaine to carry. It's not a one-time occurrence, as I understand the record. It happens over and over.
No, but I think the government should be held to rely on the testimony of its witness. And the testimony of its witness, Mr. Davis, was that there was never any discussion between him and Mr. Young.
That's a classic conspiracy, though, where they don't even need to have the discussion.
Well, I think there was also really no participation by Mr. Davis in assisting Mr. Young with finding customers or acquiring drugs. His sole role.
Why isn't the assistance of concealing the drugs while they're in the car? I mean, it maybe the police wouldn't be fooled by it, but if they were stopped and they searched, you know, Mr. Young, there wouldn't be anything on him, and there wouldn't be anything in the car either, and maybe Mr. Davis would get away with it. I'm not saying it's the most sophisticated strategy, but it strikes me as it could have been a strategy.
Well, we're not arguing that he did not aid and abet the conspiracy, the transaction.
We're arguing, fine line.
And it is a fine line, but I think this court does make that distinction. It has made that distinction in a couple of other cases. We cite the Ortega case and also the Zafiro case, and I think this is a case where that distinction is appropriate. The court has before said that the difference is that there has to be evidence of an agreement, whereas with aiding and abetting, there should be evidence that there's a desire that the transaction succeed. And certainly that evidence was here because Mr. Davis would receive crack cocaine and if the transaction would succeed. But we do not believe there was evidence of the agreement. The specific testimony of Mr. Davis was that No, I never talked to him about it. He basically didn't say why they were going to Columbus, Indiana.
But, you know, I mean, he knows he's carrying cocaine. He's not disputing that, is he?
No, he's not, and he testified that
and
he knew it was cocaine.
I just don't know of any rule of law that says the agreement has to be verbal, either oral or written.
I think it could be an implied agreement, but I...
Isn't there some communication between Young and Belmar also that's recorded where he's trying to figure out how to do this cooking?
There was discussion of how to make crack into or powder into crack, but there were no transactions between them. It was on one date. So we don't believe that there's evidence of a conspiracy. There's no agreement to commit any crime. There was just a discussion about how to cook powder into crack. But... as the court said in Ortega, you can assist an enterprise and want it to succeed without being a party to the agreement under which the enterprise was created or is being operated. And I think that's the distinction with Mr. Davis. He was not a party to any agreement that Mr. Young had with Mr. French or Ms. Taggart, who was also who they were also selling. Mr. Young was selling drugs to.
And how do you knock out Mr. French?
Well, we believe that was a separate conspiracy, that relying on the evidence of Mr. Young's transactions with Mr. French would be a variance from the indictment that was charged.
When you concede that, though, don't you concede your case? Because the indictment's very broad and it says conspired with so-and-so and so and diverse other individuals, diverse other persons, which could include French.
But the indictment was specific as to the manner and means of the of how Mr. Young assisted the conspiracy, which was to sell powder cocaine with Mr. Davis for Mr. Mockaby. And the government, I think, has conceded that there isn't evidence of a conspiracy between Mr. Young and Mr. Mockaby. There has to be evidence of the charged conspiracy for... to save a variance that is ultimately proved at trial, a varying conspiracy. And we don't believe that there was evidence of the charged conspiracy because of the lack of evidence between Mr. Young and Mr. Mockaby. Mr. Young was the subject of, I believe, less than 10 telephone calls. There were 10,000 telephone calls intercepted. Many of them were played at the trial. The trial was about a week long, and Mr. Young's participation in those telephone calls was very minimal. He was on less than 10, and it occurred only over three dates towards the very end of the conspiracy. I will reserve the rest of my time if I have any. Thank you.
But thank you very much. Next, Mr. Ansel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Harold Ansel on behalf of Alicia Drake. Your Honors, in this case, opinion testimony was used not to explain factual evidence, but to substitute for factual evidence. And it was used to draw unwarranted conclusions as that substitution for evidence. Detective Clark was qualified as an expert in drug code, and we'll concede that he probably also, although not explicitly, would have been qualified as an expert in the tactics and methods of drug dealers. However, his opinions were not based on his expertise, but were rather based on his general knowledge of the investigation. And
so are you saying that they weren't... I want to draw a fine distinction here, whether his opinions were based on his expertise about drugs or whether the record explains how that expertise is being applied here. Because, you know, he keeps saying, well, I listened to all these phone calls and I've been in this business for a while. And then he says, ergo, the word one means 1 ounce. The word one doesn't mean 1 gram. It doesn't mean one eighth of an ounce. It doesn't mean anything else. So maybe there is something in all those conversations that would give context to the word one, but it doesn't come out.
it doesn't come out, despite a lengthy attempt to cross-examine him as to his bases. And the problem, I think...
So what were you expecting in that cross-examination?
I was expecting to get to the data upon which he applied his methodology.
So he says, so you were hoping that he would say, you know, on such and such a day, the word one was used in the conversation, and then when we stopped the car, there was an ounce.
Sure, something. Something that I could identify what it was he was basing it on, and then try to attack it. But what he did kind of a, I would call it a dual witness rope-a-dope. He bounced back and forth between, oh, well, it's my training and experience, I've got many, many years, and then he'd say, well, there were 10,000 calls in this. Opinions were formed. In fact, at one point, with respect to his opinion that Drake intended to go deal with a crack cocaine customer, and then she intended to go see Lonnie Belmar to obtain crack cocaine, that was based on nothing more than a phone call where she says, oh, hey, my homegirl in from out of town, I'm going to go holler at her real quick, and then I'll be back to holler at you. So it crossing this witness to the base as to the basis for that opinion, he ultimately just said, and on direct, it was ostensibly his training and experience. So one would think, okay, it's drug code. He's talking about holler at, or he's talking about homegirl. However, on cross, he denied that homegirl was code for crack cocaine customer. And when I asked him whether holler at was some kind of code for buy crack cocaine, I didn't get the question. I asked the question twice. First, it was objected to because it was apparently a compound question. I don't think it was. It was the same question, just maybe asked with too many words. I asked again, and it was objected to. It was vague. Had to be some kind of a context. So I ended up asking him what was his basis. And his basis was there were 10,000 calls in this.
A couple
right.
of times. Right?
So, and I think the real problem with that opinion and the basis of it is he said something to the effect of determinations were made, opinions were formed. So instead of basing his conclusion about the meaning of the conversation on the drug code, which is ostensibly his expertise, he based his interpretation of those words on his assumption about the meaning of the conversation, which
didn't
was...
I thought he did on a couple of occasions back up. There'd be one of the, you know, to create some foundation for his interpretation. So he would listen to a conversation about I'm going to holler at you and I'm going to holler at that other person, and then he'd have a traffic stop performed, and there would be something that revealed that indeed drug dealing was going on.
There was some of that. For instance, the address means what kind of drugs do you want. They hear it over and over again. They know it's a crack house from surveillance, and they know it's a crack house from some of the interdictions that they did. However, the opinions that distinguished Drake as a co-conspirator rather than a buyer-seller had none of that. They had no foundational support. It was literally his naked opinion based on his broad knowledge of the investigation and based on his training and experience. So when I try to cross him, he might as well be a psychic. He says, well, based on my training and experience and everything I know about this case, these transactions involved 1 ounce quantities. Or this conversation with Lonnie Belmar evidenced her intent to go deal with a crack cocaine customer and then to go buy crack cocaine from Lonnie Belmar. So and the case is warned about that in dual testimony. There's no way to cross. He just bounces back and forth. And if that is a sufficient basis, then there's no limit to what he can say.
Well, he could make up the whole thing, or
exactly.
He could be accurate about the whole thing.
Right.
You understand, we do accept experts based on experience.
Sure, absolutely. And I don't have a problem with that, but I think in this case, a dual-capacity witness was misused, and he strayed beyond the scope of his expertise, and he started rendering opinions that were really no more than conclusions based on what he thinks he knows about the investigation. And part of the problem with that is we have to trust him to know the limits of his own knowledge. And there's no way to test it. There's no way to challenge it. So in this case, there are three opinions that really make the difference between a buyer-seller and a co-conspirator. One is the conversation with Lonnie Belmar, in which I think the government essentially manufactured a crack cocaine relationship between Drake and Belmar, and that I think they fortified with that with what I called in my brief phantom evidence that he operated a crack house. They didn't search the house. They didn't do any surveillance that would reveal that. The evidence that Lonnie Belmar operated a crack house was nothing more than assigning the label in a leading question and inviting the witness to agree to that, and that's what he did. And then when there was evidence later that he wasn't a crack house, and it really doesn't make sense that it was a crack house because Ramon Maccabee had the crack house. In fact, when Devin Hudgens needed to buy drugs, Lonnie Belmar took him to Maccabee's house. That was the crack house. The second opinion that I think sets Drake apart or purports to set Drake apart from a co-conspirator or from a buyer-seller to a co-conspirator is is the 1 ounce means one ounce of crack cocaine, which suggests further distribution, or the one equals 1 ounce. And is it one that he's interpreting? Ostensibly it's one, but she says one of those. So those must be in 1 ounce, or ounce, but there's no base. Again, there's no basis for it. And the third is the conversation that the court alluded to, which was, hey, you're slipping and you're pimping, and my business is your business. We have no idea what that means. I mean, he's her drug dealer. He's Dr. Feelgood. I mean, of course she's going to try to cozy up to him. And, I mean, I don't see that as any different than, for instance, a barfly trying to get personal with her bartender. I mean, that's, without some substantive evidence to set her apart, there's nothing more. And I see that my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And lastly, we'll hear from Mr. Uhler.
Good morning, Your Honor's counsel. May it please the court. My name is Joshua Euler. I represent Juan Carlos Adame Hernandez. Mr. Adame and the government entered into a plea agreement in this case pursuant to Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11C1C.
So let me ask you what for me is the most important question. All of that happened, and I'm willing to assume for right now anyway with you that the district court misunderstood what was going on during the proceeding where Mr. Adame is saying, you know, I want it to be relevant conduct, not my personal stuff, but it's still a 38. I mean, that's a very confused exchange. But let's assume she was wrong and she made a mistake when she revoked her earlier acceptance of that subpart C plea agreement. Nonetheless, Mr. Adame comes along later in the beginning of October and he enters into another plea, this time a blind plea with no agreement. And that's where I get stuck on this, because once he does that, whatever went before of a non-jurisdictional nature is off the table under Bros.
Well, and that's definitely the hat that the hook that the government hangs its hat on here.
And why is it wrong is what I'm asking you.
Right. I think that's wrong, Your Honor. Waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. And
but
nothing.
Why? Okay, so you're saying when he comes in to plead in early October, he's doing it based on the district court, as I said, for purposes of discussion right now, the district court's mistaken interpretation of everything was going on. But he doesn't try to get the government to allow him to take that challenge forward. He doesn't in any way condition the guilty plea in October.
I think the district court's colloquy with the defendant gave the defendant the belief that he was still entitled to address these issues on appeal. Judge Barker indicated, she said...
What date are we talking about?
In the October, the second
plea. The October 2nd.
Judge Barker indicated that first there had been no appellate waiver in the
right.
in the plea. She also said that you have a separate right to appeal, even if you enter your plea, even if you plead guilty to these charges, that's a right to appeal the sentence that's imposed. So you've not given up that right, but you've given up your right to appeal, we say, the merits of the case. That means the sufficiency of the government's evidence that underlies these charges. You've given that right of appeal up. And that's not really the issue that Mr. Adame is contesting.
Well, I know, but he doesn't have any fixed right to a 204-month sentence once the subpart C plea agreement has disappeared. I mean, at that point, sure, he does have the right to complain about how his guidelines range is calculated. He has the right to make 3553A arguments. He has the right to do the usual things that one sees on an appeal. But I don't see how he reaches back to a sentence that was actually tied up with an appellate waiver, a sentence that was part of a deal that, rightly or wrongly, the district court set aside.
Well, I think there's a couple problems there. First is, just as a general policy matter, if a prosecutor develops buyer's remorse about a plea agreement that he tenders to a defendant and is able to effectively back out or urge the court to back out, and then a defendant is left with an option to either go to trial or simply plead guilty again and maybe get the same deal from the court, hopefully as a means of efficiency, it seems that that would be the advisable thing to do. Mr. Adame had never intended to contest the case or take the case to trial. So there's that concern. The second is sort of the general principle behind this rule, general rule, and I don't believe that the rule that a guilty plea waives all non-jurisdictional defects that occurred prior to the plea is absolute. All the decisions that have addressed it, that you say the general rule, or say ordinarily, a guilty plea.
What are the exceptions that you've found?
Well, there's the exception when there's a matter of double jeopardy. This court has held that a defendant may subsequently challenge a conviction on appeal where there's double jeopardy concerns that weren't preserved by a conditional plea agreement. There's post-Lopez, I cite in my brief, an opinion indicating that there are several courts, circuit courts, that allow defendants to challenge post-Lopez convictions that without addressing the guilty plea waiver rule. There's I believe it was a Fourth Circuit case that allowed it.
Jurisdictional? Because, of course, Gross recognizes jurisdictional challenges.
Correct. And I think there's an argument here that this is a jurisdictional issue. Because after Mr. Adame pled guilty, conceivably jeopardy attached. And the whole idea is that the guilty plea rule prevents, or the double jeopardy prevents, the district court from hauling a defendant back into court after
she
conviction.
Didn't do that. Well,
yeah, right. And with her ability to decline to impose the sentence, it's hard for me to see jeopardy there.
Well, I would concede that that's not Mr. Adame's best argument. I think Mr. Adame's argument sort of falls under an exception to the general rule that the government is hanging its hat on and the court is appropriately concerned with. The Supreme Court in the Mena case sort of indicated that the rule we're discussing here is premised on the idea that a counseled plea of guilty is an admission of factual guilt so reliable that, where voluntary and intelligent, it quite validly removes the issue of factual guilt from the case. In most cases, factual guilt is a sufficient basis for the state's imposition of punishment. A guilty plea, therefore, simply renders irrelevant those constitutional violations not logically inconsistent with the valid establishment of factual guilt and which do not stand in the way of a conviction if factual guilt is validly established.
But as you were pointing out, for Mr. Adame, factual guilt has never been the issue. It's been all about the sentence and the difference between, if you will, a subpart C sentence and either a blind plea or a regular, subpart B plea agreement. And he would like the benefit of the sentence because of this mix-up that occurred.
And it is a significant mix-up.
Yeah, it is. And it's a significant detriment to him. It's 96 months. So
ultimately, through no fault of his own, that's his position.
Okay.
So for those reasons, Your Honors, we'd ask the court to vacate the conviction and remand the case, reimpose or reinsert the original plea agreement.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Euler. Mr. Blackington.
Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to just correct one thing on the record that might not be clear, and then talk a bit about the expert witness issue, and then the balance of my time when there are 23 issues and sub-issues, it's hard to figure out what the court's interested in. So that's at least where I'd like to start with the presentation. The first issue that was raised in Ms. Ursulskas's argument today was the presence of this tracking order on Mr. Jones's phone. And I just wanted to make it clear, and it's supported in the record, that the tracking order is valid for 45 days. It's a precision location order. But it's not the type of technology where you're able to track somebody consecutively for a 45-day period and see where they are every second of the day. Rather, what happens is the cellular telephones emit a signal, and every time the agency wants to find out where somebody is, they have to call the telephone company pursuant to this order. And at that point, the telephone company sends out a signal, determines where the phone is, and tells the agency where it is. So this isn't a situation where the FBI knew technology-wise where he was every minute of those 45 days. They knew where he was on the two occasions where they contacted the phone company.
So they asked twice. I mean, that's very helpful. I appreciate that. What I'm concerned about on that issue is exactly what Ms. Ursulskas was talking about, the fact that it's two times. I mean, I might spend the night two times at my daughter's place in New York, and it doesn't mean it's my residence, and it doesn't mean I have any connection to all the stuff she has around her her apartment. Two times seems to me very weak to show anything more than an overnight guest situation. I don't see, and of course your car's parked outside. That's just cumulative evidence. If you're an overnight guest, your car's going to be parked out there too. So I'm concerned, since what this all feeds into is the government's argument that all of the items found in that house could be associated with Mr. Jones. That's your case right there. And if he's really just a guest in somebody else's place that he doesn't have any other relationship with, boy, that's weak.
Well, as far as the, I think if I can take the back half of your statement first, as far as the evidence at trial, the conviction evidence, he's there, he's arrested when they search the place. There are all of the telephone calls where he's ordering crack cocaine. So I don't think it's weak at all on the evidence of guilt side of the transaction.
I don't know. I mean, I think it is, in that there's very little inside this house to connect that crack cocaine to him. It's not like so many other cases where we've seen, you know, that either there's other evidence inside the house that shows that the person really lives there, some of the time at least, you know, mail or medications or clothing or other kinds of things. He's sleeping there two nights.
His cellular phones that found there in...
nowhere near any of this stuff.
Near the digital scales.
No, but the digital scales are like inside a closet. It's not very near the digital scales.
The digital scales of cocaine residue, a large amount of the crack cocaine that's found open in the kitchen. And what you have in this case that
you don't know, why is that his? Why does that connect? So any house he walks into is his residence? If he walks in twice?
Well, I think you can infer that it is. And again,
the government is arguing that when somebody goes to a house twice, that makes it his residence for purposes of all this. Drug dealers like to keep things at their residence.
For purposes of a search warrant, it creates a reasonable inference that it's his residence, I think.
I mean, that's a stunning rule that you're asking for.
Well, particularly, there's nobody else where he's placed. And as Judge Barker noted in her opinion, and the court noted in the questioning of Ms. Ursulskis, this is drug traffickers live a different life than the rest of us. They don't, as Judge Barker noted, they don't put utilities in their own names.
I understand that. So what I'm worried about is twice in the same place. The government had the ability to create a much stronger record than you did, and there's a lot of evidence that's not in this record about other places he might have been. You haven't distinguished him from somebody who's an overnight guest two times.
Well, I would beg to differ that there's been we've shown that there's a fair probability that contraband would be found at that location based on Mr. Jones's tie to it. And again, for a search warrant.
So you think contraband would be found any place he spends two nights?
Well, I think it would be found anywhere a drug dealer lives. And I think, again,
there's. We don't know that he lives there. We know he spent two nights there.
I think we have a reasonable inference that he lives there.
Why? Because he spent two nights there? I've spent two nights at my daughter's place.
I think they're several days apart. There's an absence of
five
any.
Days apart.
Right. That's also close in time to when the search warrants are executed. So I think that gives a reasonable inference that that's where he lives. And I think the judges, the district court found that, and I think the district court's finding was reasonable. And in the event that that is the court's opinion, that two times isn't enough, I would suggest that the good faith exception applies and validates the warrant, as I've argued in my brief.
Sure. And I guess just to be clear, I'm a little less worried about the warrant, per se, because of the Leon existence than I am about the validity of the inference that whatever is in the house is tied to him, since we are missing so many typical links between what's in the house and Mr. Jones.
I think, though, the thing that's present here that's not typical, that's not present in the typical constructive possession case that we see, and frankly isn't present in any of the other cases that I read that this court's issued, and I don't pretend to have read every constructive possession case from this court. Yeah, but I think the thing that's present here that we haven't seen in the other cases that I've read is the volume of telephone calls where Mr. Jones is buying and selling crack cocaine. That's not there in the typical constructive possession case. And I think
you have to get the stuff in the house. I mean, your theory seems to be what I think of as kind of a Pigpen theory, that, you know, that he walks around like the Peanuts character Pigpen with this swirl of drugs around him. And every time he walks into a place, it therefore becomes a place where there are going to be drugs and guns.
Well, I think we're going back and forth a little bit here between the search warrant issues
and
the guilt
issues. No,
I'm not
at all on the search warrant issue. You say that the reason he possesses, that there's a connection between him and the things found in the house, is because he resided in the house.
I think the best evidence is that the police go into the house, he's there. So that's the third time. We have the two telephone calls and the fact that he's there in the morning of the arrest. The crack cocaine's out in the kitchen table, out by the sink and in other places. And you have the telephone call showing that he has been regularly receiving distribution quantities of crack. I think those telephone calls help connect him to the crack.
There's another occupant of this house, right?
There's a female.
Right. And what evidence did the government introduce to exclude her as a to make it more likely that he was the one that possessed the drug?
There wasn't any. I think what I would suggest to the court is the absence of other evidence, such as telephone calls, including her, I would suggest it wasn't her. But if we wanted to look
were
at
were there questions asked about that, whether she showed up on any of the calls?
No, there were not. But I think if we wanted to look at it as a joint possession issue, that would be an acceptable basis as well. I think the main thing, again, is the police enter, the crack's out in plain view in the house, a large majority of it. His cellular phone's there in the same room with digital scales with
drugs. But the scales are in a shoebox in the closet. His cellular phone is not in a shoebox in the closet.
Well, drug dealers sometimes keep their digital scales in a box, and
I know, but you're trying to say it is cell phone. I mean, again, like other cases, the cell phone will be right there in the kitchen next to the drugs, or it'll be right there next to the scale, or next to the baking powder, or whatever. And this case is much weaker than that.
Except for the presence of the phone calls, Your Honor, which again show that he's regularly buying and selling crack cocaine.
He's the only person in Indianapolis who's doing that?
Well, and then you go into the house and there's crack cocaine. I think it's a convincing case. And so did the jury. But with that, unless the court has any more questions on that issue, I'd like to move on to the expert testimony issue. And the first thing that I think needs to be brought to the forefront in this proceeding is that there were no objections at all that were made at the district court level about the admission of this expert testimony, none whatsoever. So we're up on a plain error standard.
But we it's one thing to be an expert, and I agree with you. I don't see anybody contesting the expertise of Officer Clark, right? But it's not enough, as we've said, to stand up and say, I'm an expert, therefore believe everything I'm about to say. It's not enough if it's an economist. It's not enough if it's an officer in the drug business. It's not enough if it's a geological engineer. You've got to show that you applied your expertise in some valid way to the data, to the material before you. And I'm very concerned with the way Clark just says it means, holler at means go have a, cocaine sale because I say it means that. The people who decoded the Rosetta Stone didn't do it that way. They cross-referenced various things. They built up a record of what different phrasings, different symbols would mean, and Clark doesn't give us any help to say whether he's just making this up in his head or whether it makes any sense against the real world.
Well, I think he does in the context. First, he's relying on his training and experience.
Well, we know
but
all
going
of that.
Beyond
that means
that.
He's an expert, but what is he doing? Why does holler at mean have a sale as opposed to, as it often does in certain communities, just mean I'm going to give you a phone call?
Because what's happening in this case is you don't just have the training and experience, but you have the training and experience as is applied to the telephone calls that he's interpreting.
He gives us examples. He never says, out of the 10,000 phone calls, the phrase holler at is used X number of times. I've tested, kind of sample tested, and when it's used, we found that a transaction would take place. We don't know anything about how he derived these opinions based on his extensive expertise.
Well, he did testify that he tested it out insofar as there were at least four interdiction stops done, that following telephone calls with similar code language, either powder cocaine or crack cocaine was seized. He also indicated that he tested it out as far as obtaining search warrants for various locations. Mr. Mockaby's house, his stash location, Kenneth Jones's, if we call it a residence or otherwise. So he did provide a basis for those opinions. And
each phrase that he testifies to? I mean, he testifies to a lot of different code, the word one, holler at, sting, what's the address, and I can't remember all the others, but there are quite a few things that he purports to decode.
He did not go into that type of detail with each phrase, but this is not at all unlike, for instance, the Sabalos case that I cited in my opinion. The code language and the testimony in that case was exactly the same as it was here. He was asked in the Sabalos case opinions about code language such as it, that, similar opinions about languages used by drug couriers, and this court found it appropriate in the Sabalos case, and that's been done in quite a few cases here. And
but very often you'll have a cooperating witness who's an insider who is competent to say, when my group says sting, we mean a customer. And that's quite different from, you know, you or me or Officer Clark or somebody else reading a bunch of transcripts and figuring out what these words mean.
In this case, there was some of that testimony. Devon Hudgens talked about the meaning of a sting being a drug user or drug addict. He also testified, and my mind's blank about the exact phrase he used, but he did talk about words like come on over, holler at, those types of things involving drug transactions. So that evidence is present as well. He testified that Mr. Mockabee specifically avoided using phrases like crack cocaine.
Of course, yeah.
And even you know, things like CDs, birds, chickens, that we sometimes hear were not used in this case either. So I think that the basis, and again, there's never, at the district court level, there's never an objection to any of these opinions that's being made. There's not one single objection made that, hey, the use of the word,
It sort of comes in the other direction, though. The difficulty, one of the difficulties with this is, how do you cross-examine a witness who gives really just nothing but a bald opinion? The one is very important, being an ounce as opposed to 1 gram or 1/10 of a gram or whatever it might be, and it's virtually impossible to examine on, and pretty difficult to review as well. From the appellate perspective, without the bases for these opinions.
And again, I'd suggest the bases in this opinion's training, the training and experience of the agent. And I understand why the...
Where in their training teaches them that one means 1 ounce and that could mean anything.
I understand why you rolled your eyes a little bit there, but it goes back to the Kumho Tire case where the Supreme Court talks about cases that involve scientific engineering.
You're talking about an automobile mechanic who's, fixed, I'm actually reminded of my cousin Vinny, who's fixed lots of cars. And the person says, I know the tires on this car work this way because I've worked with them for years, and here's where the tread is, and here's what is there in the suspension. And so they don't just say, trust me, I know what the tires work like. They give reasons, foundational reasons, and that's what Clark does not do.
And I think the foundational reasons are here, perhaps if there would have been objections and I would have been asked to bring it up, but some of that comes in terms of the quantities, the opinion quantities about the amount of cocaine that's received. Kilo quantities coming in from Dominic Robinson and Damon Luter. Then what's found during the interdiction, and it becomes somewhat a process of addition where you can tell that one, in this case, can't mean a kilo because there are 8 or 9 transactions involving one and the math wouldn't be there. and you look at, you know, smaller transactions, if it's a gram, likewise it doesn't add up to a kilo. So that type of evidence is there. It was presented, and there's simply, you know, if there aren't objections to these types of things, you know, it creates, it's difficult to respond to at this point, because when we conduct trials as lawyers and you know, district court judges, the same thing, when we're conducting these trials, if there's a fact that doesn't seem to be challenged or an opinion that doesn't seem to be challenged, there's a tendency to keep going.
Of course.
And I don't. Those opinions were not challenged by objections. And the other thing I'd note is that until today, there wasn't the assertion from defense counsel that maybe these are lay opinions and not expert opinions. So that wasn't even made until today.
Before you go on with this, just because there's, as you pointed out, a great deal, I wanted to turn your attention to the part of the appeal that concerns the closing arguments and the misstatements at closing arguments. So there, this is, I think, part of Drake's case. I'm not sure if it was you or whomever, but the government stated that Poole testified that in the winter we didn't go to Belmar's house for social purposes to hang out. We didn't go there because there was no heat in the house, and there's an objection made to that. So that's just flatly wrong. You know, if you go back and look at Poole's testimony, there's a question, would you ever hang out with Lonnie Belmar in 25th Street? Question, would he have people over to his house to not only drink but smoke marijuana? Yes. He was more like the little party house. People would drink and smoke at his house, inside and out. So in the wintertime, people would drink alcohol and smoke? Yes. And then redirect, was there any furniture in there? He was fixing it up. Am I correct? The house is basically gutted to the studs. That's basically what he was doing every day, like gutting it out and fixing it up. And that there's never testimony that there's no heat in the house. There's testimony that there are chairs, and there's testimony that they did go there in the winter.
The testimony gutted to the studs means a house, everything's been removed.
I understand what gutted to the studs means, but he says like gutting it out and fixing it up. So we don't know if the heating unit had been removed or not. We don't know at what stage fixing it up. I think that is, well, first of all, the statement that they didn't go there in the winter isn't true, because he says, yes, they did go there in the winter. Whether they were cold or not was their problem. The gutted to the studs didn't say there was no heat in the house.
I think when a house is gutted to the studs, it means there's not a heating instrument.
Well, what about the fixing it up part? He was doing every day, like gutting it out and fixing it up.
Well,
and then it says, so it's gutted to the studs and there's little or no furniture there. Is that right? He had chairs in there. So,
okay.
And he says people went there.
So you have a couple of chairs and some studs.
Right. And so you said he testified in the winter we didn't go to Belmar's house. We didn't go there because there is no heat. Poole never says that. He says, yes, we did. There were chairs in there. It was the party house.
He said it was gutted to the studs,
but
and I was...
they went.
I was incorrect when I said that.
Right. So, and the problem with that is it really gets to Drake's arguments about whether there's this big conspiracy going on or whether there's just a buyer-seller point.
I don't see that it does, because that doesn't involve Mockaby's house at all.
Well, Belmar's house.
Belmar.
And Drake objects to the statement that Belmar's house was a crack house because there's nothing in the record
and
that says
the,
it was.
The testimony twice was, yeah, that was his crack house.
Well, because you said in your investigation, where do you believe Ramon Mockaby's crack house is located? You assumed the answer to the question. It's as leading a question as I can imagine.
There's no objection to it based on a leading question, and there's testimony in there establishing that it's his crack house. That's what the answer was to the question.
Well, it's a compound question, basically. Yes, you could. Where is the house located? 781 West 25th Street. Where's Belmar's? 736 West 25th Street. They could be answering the location part of that question. They could be answering, is it a crack house part of that question. It's completely ambiguous. And then the follow-up makes it look like it's location. They are on the same block. Yes.
I don't think it's ambiguous at all. It's a straightforward question, and I know
It's not the question, was it a crack house?
It's, was this crack house located there? It's presumed in the question, and so the record does support the conclusion that that's where its crack house is. It's a clear, direct question. Again, there's, you know, we want to...
It's a very ambiguous question, actually, because it could be read to give two different answers.
I didn't see it that way.
I'm sure you didn't, but I might. Anyway, on Mr. Adame, I'm very disturbed by the process by which the first plea agreement was rejected, because there was no notice, as there should have been. It was all done in a very quick basis, a very confused transcript, and I think the district court might have been under the misapprehension that he was withdrawing his concession that 150 kilos were involved, and he was not. He was just saying part of it was me and part of it was relevant conduct.
But if that's the case, the factual predicate, this isn't a situation where there was any basis for him to argue that there was any other relevant conduct there.
But he's agreeing to the 150 kilos, so I don't see why his, and indeed you seem to be, not sure initially. I don't see why it's a material change if it's 150 no matter how you add up the 150.
Unless you say in that plea that he's the person dealing 150 kilos or more, there's no factual predicate anywhere to reach the conclusion that he's accountable at level 38 for 150 kilos.
You can be accountable for 150 kilos through 50 kilos of your own and 100 kilos of your co-conspirators.
Sure, but there's no evidence anywhere of any other co-conspirator who could fill in that 100 kilos.
It wouldn't matter if he's admitting it, would it? He's prepared to admit that the group is dealing with 150 kilos.
I don't think it's acceptance. Well, I don't think it's acceptance of responsibility if he's not.
That's a different issue. The district court seemed to think that what was going on, and actually, again, I want to stress, had this been done correctly, there would have been a period of time, there would have been a hearing at which it would have been the topic for discussion would have been whether there is a good reason to have the district court revoke its acceptance of the plea agreement, and that never happens. It just happens in the space of 5 minutes. You know, I read through the transcript, and people are talking all over the place. Nobody knows what anybody is saying, and it's a mess.
Well, I think the court knew full well what it was doing. The court, in the end, said, these issues aside about whether he's accepted responsibility or whether, you know, the 150 kilos is either accountable for him because he distributed directly or other unknown foreseeability issues, the court said at the end, I'm not accepting this plea because it's not enough jail time.
And that's where the process of withdrawing, because there earlier had been a moment at which the court had said, I am accepting the plea. So this wasn't the first hearing when the plea agreement is put in front of the court. This is a later process. So Rule 11, C5, the court rejects a plea agreement of the capital C type, have to do the following on the record, inform, advise defendant personally, blah, 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 you know. That process does not happen.
I think it happened at that hearing.
No, I'm saying I think, you know, he tries at the end of the hearing to say, fine, I agree to everything. And she says, no, it's too late.
Well, the court rejected the plea at that point.
Revoked her. I'm not going to say rejected. She revoked her acceptance of the plea.
Okay. The court already either rejected or revoked her acceptance of the plea at that point. But the court did everything on the record, and it was clear from the record why the court did so.
We'll see. I'll give you another minute if there was anything else that you wanted to raise. And I'm going to give defense counsel a minute apiece if they have any further comments.
There was dealing with expert testimony, but we moved away from it, and I can't remember what the point was that I wanted to make. So.
Fine on expert testimony.
Pardon?
I think we're fine on that. I believe we have your position.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. So I'll just go down the list. Anything further, Ms. Ursulskis?
No, Your Honor, but thank you for y'all.
Sure. Mr. Daisy?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Mr. Mullins?
No, thank you.
All right. Mr. Ansel?
Yes, sir, very briefly.
Okay.
I'd just like to point out that after the misstatement about the facts in the record, the government went on to say that Lonnie Belmar's house was a crack house, and that's what she was warning him about. And what's interesting is she calls Lonnie and says, hey, there's police in the area. And he says, did you call Moan, meaning Ramon Maccabee? And she seems confused. She says, no, why was I supposed to? And she says, oh, okay, I'll call him. But she never did. So she wasn't trying to warn the person who actually ran the crack house. And the interdictions and the search warrants, there was no data or evidence or information that supported any of the conclusions with respect to Drake.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Euler, anything further?
If Mr. Adame has waived his right to appeal this issue by virtue of his guilty plea, I think he then can attack the validity of the underlying plea, the second plea that he gave in October. While it would be reviewed for plain error, the court could still evaluate whether that second plea was a knowing and voluntary act on his part. The colloquy that the court had with the defendant, the absence of a plea agreement, suggests this distinct possibility that Mr. Adame did believe he retained the right to appeal the district court's vacating of that original plea agreement and the breach, whether it was his breach or the government's breach. Either way, I do believe that we can get to the same result and set the case back to the court by virtue of withdrawing the plea. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement, and our particular thanks